Well, thank you to everybody for coming. So the idea of the talk I'm about to give is that even though this is a session about nutrition and I submitted the abstract to the food and nutrition section, and 90% of what I do is nutrition policy research, this talk actually isn't really about nutrition. It's sort of about the forgotten half of the energy balance equation, which is more physical activity policy research, although I will be incorporating both of them into this talk. And I am going to start with nutrition once I tell you I have no relationships to disclose. Because, as you may have heard, school nutrition policy research is a hot topic these days. We've already heard of a couple very innovative programs, and in the last decade, we've seen this huge push from federal, state, and local policymakers who have promoted many initiatives that are designed to reduce obesity by improving school nutrition standards. Common policies include banning sodas in schools, improving USDA school meal standards, and setting limits on the fat, sugar, and calorie content for competitive food, which refers to food sold outside of federal meal programs. There's growing research in this area, and more studies are finding that policies have been effective in at least improving the nutritional quality of school foods and might even reduce student weight gain. Now, my co-authors and I actually did a study on weight gain that was published in Pediatrics a couple months ago. We focused just on competitive food laws in that study, and we found that students gained less weight over time if they lived in states with strong competitive food laws with standards that were specific, required, and consistent over time. Now, I bring this study up for a few reasons. One, because the study I'm presenting today is sort of a complement to that one. Two, because... sorry, I forgot the second reason. Completely lost my train of thought. Well, I'll skip the second reason. The other reason was because I was just fascinated by sort of the passionate response that this study got, both for better and for worse. I believe one article in the Washington Examiner referred to it as junk science about junk food. I've definitely learned from doing research in this area that anytime you just bring up the general idea of government regulating what people are going to eat, you're going to piss some people off, and you're going to get a lot of enemies. But we also have our passionate advocates, and my favorite response by far was this man. Now, I don't often quote rap lyrics when I give a talk, or any other time for that matter, because I can confidently say I am the least hip, least cool person in this room, as my girlfriend would attest to. And that's why I was really fascinated, though, to see when I found out that this rapper from New York City actually wrote a blog about school nutrition right after our study came out, in which he actually quoted a couple of the studies that we did. And he also wrote a song, as you can see, about the importance of school nutrition and made a music video about it. So for somebody who's as much of a public health nerd as I am, that was pretty exciting. But I think it also points to the fact that school nutrition policy is a topic that doesn't just interest policymakers and public health nerds. It's really a topic that gets the general public going because it's something people are often passionate about. Physical education just isn't. It just has not inspired people to the same degree. Even though we know obesity is caused by a mixture of how many calories people consume and how many they expend, we just haven't gotten as much interest in the expenditure side of things. Policymakers and researchers have not focused on it to the same degree. There's sort of been this nutrition bias in the last decade because many more states have been focusing on competitive food laws compared to physical education laws. The National Association for Sport and Physical Education recommends 225 minutes of PE per week for middle school students. Anybody want to guess the number of states that required such standards in 2006? Any guesses? Zero. I heard it in the audience somewhere. Now, there have been one or two states since then, but it's still a very low number. And there's all sorts of reasons for this. Certainly, there's the pressure to meet academic standards. In this No Child Left Behind era, PE is often the first thing on the chopping block when schools feel pressured to focus on academics more. There's also the focus on varsity sports. Some people believe that sports gets emphasized too much and schools are devoting too many of their resources to sports instead of general physical education. But then there's also just the lack of evidence that these laws work. Not too many studies have been done in this area, but the studies that have been done generally found that laws had, at best, a modest association with physical activity and no association with obesity. The one exception to that was Kim in a recent study found that, in bivariate analyses at least, she found that PE laws, or schools requiring PE, was associated with obesity in 2007, but not in 2003, which I thought was interesting. And she speculated that this might be because 2003 to 2007 was a period when a lot of states were passing stronger nutrition laws and it may have taken the combination of the two before you saw any effect on obesity. This is just speculation, though. She didn't actually test it. But that's why we designed this study, in which we sought to both determine if the strength of state PE laws is associated with PE attendance and physical activity, and then if the association between PE laws and BMI change is modified by competitive food laws. We did this using a state law database compiled by the National Cancer Institute. It's called the Classification of Laws Associated with School Students. They obtained data on all sorts of PE and nutrition laws. They obtained the laws themselves from a Westlaw legal research database, and they did this annually from 2003 to 2008. As I said, they collect all sorts of laws, but we specifically focused on those governing PE time requirements, so how much time did students have to participate in PE per week, and then competitive food laws. Each of these were rated on a scale of 0 to 5 for PE and 0 to 6 for competitive foods. And ratings are generally a reflection of a combination of the strength of language in the law, how specific do the standards get, and how stringent are standards. So we took those ratings and then we classified states as having either strong, weak, or no laws at all for both PE and competitive foods. You can see we use slightly different criteria for PE and competitive foods. We purposely chose these criteria to create substantively meaningful categories that had a very clear definition. So, for example, a weak PE law would be considered one that did require PE but didn't go into any specific detail about how much was required, whereas a strong law would be one that did give a specific amount. Unfortunately, we couldn't go any stronger than that because only six states in this study even met that criteria, so we had to set the bar pretty low just to generate any variation. And then for competitive food laws, a weak law would be considered one that either simply recommended nutrition standards rather than requiring them, or required healthy foods without defining what healthy means. And then we linked the law data with student data from the Early Childhood Longitudinal Study. For those who aren't familiar with ECLSK, it was a cohort that was followed from kindergarten through eighth grade, including seven rounds of data collection. And we specifically utilized data from rounds six and seven when students were in fifth grade and eighth grade. And our study sample included about 5,500 students in 40 states. The dependent variables were PE attendance, physical activity, and BMI change. PE attendance was measured by students, reported by students in eighth grade on a questionnaire in which they reported the number of days of PE on a typical week. And then we used this to create two binary measures of regular PE attendance if they reported at least 3 days per week, and then daily PE attendance if they reported it every day. And then students also reported their days of physical activity within the past week, the number of days they had at least 20 minutes of physical activity. And then BMI change was measured using objective height and weight measures that were collected in both fifth grade and eighth grade. That's really a huge advantage of ECLSK, is that you have objective measures in each round as opposed to just relying on self-reports, which we know can be very biased. Oops. Now, we took slightly different analytic approaches in the two aims. For aim one, we used mixed effect models to estimate the association between 2006 PE laws and students' eighth grade PE attendance and physical activity. We used logistic models for PE attendance and then a Poisson model for days of physical activity. We stratified this by gender and then adjusted for several student characteristics. And then we used a state-level random intercept to control for state clustering. And I'm just going to get off on a side on that for a second, because state clustering was really a huge factor in this analysis. PE attendance is a variable that tends to cluster more on the state level than most other behaviors. I show the interclass correlation coefficients on the slide there. For those who aren't familiar with ICCs, they're basically an indication of how much a behavior or any measure varies between states as opposed to within states. A typical ICC, in theory, it can range from 0 to 1, but a typical estimate would be about 0.01 or 0.02 or maybe 0.05, and the estimates were as high as 0.30 in states with strong PE laws. So this definitely suggests that there are state-level factors at play that influence PE, not just laws, but other factors as well, and it's really a critical thing to control for in the analysis. And just for the sake of comparison, I put up the ICCs for physical activity and BMI change, too. They were about 0.01. So it really is something about PE attendance, not just a quirk in the ECLSK sample. So this graph shows the results for regular PE attendance, and you can see that there is a pretty huge difference in regular attendance, particularly in girls. The proportion who reported regular attendance was about 73% in states that had strong laws, compared to about 51% in states with no laws at all. And it's interesting to note, too, that in states that had the stronger laws, the gender disparity was pretty much wiped out, that boys and girls were equally likely to have at least 3 days of PE per week. As for daily PE attendance, though, the association was not nearly as strong. In boys, it was actually a slight inverse association, though overall there basically was no difference. And in girls, it was positive, but it was nowhere near the same size as for regular PE attendance. And this really isn't a shock if you think about it, because as I said before, even the so-called strong laws were not that strong. There was no state in 2006 that was requiring 225 minutes of PE per week. So if you're not requiring daily PE, there's no reason to think you would see a major difference in daily PE. So this is just an indication, as I said, that even strong laws are not that strong. That said, we did see differences in physical activity, particularly among girls again, that their average days of activity was about 0.31 days higher in states with strong laws versus those with no laws. I don't show the results here, but it was also interesting to note that we did look at the association between days of PE and days of activity, and it was very weak in girls. It was only slightly better than zero, which is not a surprise either because there's a lot of research that shows that girls are generally not that active within PE class. But in the states that had stronger laws, you did have a much stronger association. So these laws could be benefiting students, not just in forcing them to go to PE class, but also getting them more activity in class, although it can't conclude that for certain. Now, we took a different approach for AIM 2, where we used fixed effect models to estimate the association between PE and competitive food laws and BMI change. And states were cross-classified based on their PE and competitive food laws in 2006. Now, we limited this analysis to just four categories of states. There were those that had no PE laws and no competitive food laws. There were those that were weak for PE but had no competitive food laws. There were those that were weak for both domains. And then there were those that had weak PE laws but strong competitive food laws. And that's it. These are the only states that we included in this analysis. So you're naturally going to wonder, well, what about the states with strong PE laws? Don't you want to look at them? And the simple answer is we just couldn't because there aren't enough of them. As I said, there were only six that had strong PE laws in this study, and the six of them had all sorts of combinations of competitive food laws over time, like some were consistently none, some were consistently strong, some went from weak to strong, some went from strong to weak, and that made it virtually impossible to combine the two. Trust me, I spent about a year trying to convince myself that it could be done and finally concluded that there was just no way. And this was also stratified by gender and adjusted for several characteristics. And what we basically found was that weak PE laws were not associated with BMI change, particularly in the absence of competitive food laws. You can see in boys in particular that average BMI change was actually a little bit higher in states that were weak for PE and had no competitive food laws. Now, it was lower for states that had weak PE laws and strong competitive food laws, but to put these results in perspective, and now I remember the second reason why I brought that study up, because the results we found in that study, where we looked just at strong competitive food laws, we found that they were associated with 0.44 units, fewer units of BMI change over time. So the association in that study, when we were just looking at competitive food laws, was actually a little bit stronger than what we found in this study. So at best, that suggests that weak PE laws are not having any additive benefit. They're not doing anything that strong competitive food laws were not already doing. So to summarize, weak PE laws just are not getting it done. I mean, I know that's not a very scientific way of putting it, but that's the bottom line, I think. We found that only strong laws are associated with PE attendance and physical activity, particularly among girls. I would throw in that extra cautionary note that the high degree of state clustering definitely suggests there's more at play than just PE laws, that there's other factors that modify whether these laws work or not. So it's hard to make any generalizations about whether laws are effective because it really depends on what state you're talking about. And I think that's something we need to study more. But again, there's no evidence that weak PE laws are associated with BMI change, particularly in the absence of competitive food laws. They just don't seem to have any additive benefit. I would reiterate, though, that I don't want the takeaway message to be that PE laws don't work, because it's more that PE laws, existing laws, are just too weak. And if you're going to see more of an impact, it's going to take stronger laws than what we have right now. Some key limitations to point out, we did rely on self-reported measures of physical education and physical activities, so they're obviously subject to measurement error. Both activity and PE were only reported in eighth grade by students, so we couldn't look at changes over time. We didn't have data on activity within PE class. I talked about looking at the association. That was just overall activity and overall PE. We didn't actually have a measure of how active they were within PE class. And we also didn't have data on district PE policies. And then finally, again, the limited number of states that had strong PE laws really prevented our ability to look at the combination of strong PE laws and competitive food laws. But hopefully, if states begin to develop stronger peat laws, that'll be an area for future research. Quickly, I want to acknowledge the National Cancer Institute and Institute for Education Sciences for providing the data, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute and Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for funding the study, and Tamkeen Khan, a graduate student at UIC, who really helped us quite a bit with the ECLSK data. And that'll take questions. That one study I mentioned by Kim, the one significant effect she did find, it actually wasn't the state laws themselves, it was the percentage of schools within the state that required PE. So in some ways it was more of a school measure of physical education. At the same time, it wasn't actually linking on the school level. It was more of an ecologic study. So it's short answer is no. That's as close as it gets, I think.
But I'm just talking about studies where, whether there's a law or not, whether when schools
my take on that is that you can certainly find your randomized trials that when you implement a very well-designed PE class with the necessary resources, then you can see an effect. That's not the world we live in, and a lot of schools are not able to implement it to that degree. So that's certainly encouraging to see that well-designed PE classes can do that, but I don't think that really reflects, as far as general PE, I don't think so. I mean, certainly what the National Association for Sport and Physical Education, that's the ideal of what we would like. At this point, I think only one or two states actually meet that, so that would be the closest thing. As far as competitive foods, I mean, there are certainly states like California that have set particularly strict limits for nutrition content of competitive foods. So I think states like that would probably be the model. Obviously, we hope to have national competitive food standards in the next year or so, but at this time, there isn't really a national standard.
Yep. Have you looked at internationally, like for example, the French baccalaureate, how they, it's part of the baccalaureate system to have PE, certain hours, certain competitive tests, in order to pass the kind of high school, you have to really pass PE. Did you look at what
I certainly haven't looked at that. I think there have been one or two other studies in other countries that looked at that, that their results might have been a little bit more encouraging, but I'm not 100% certain. The difficult thing, of course, is that it's hard to generalize results from another country to the United States, but I think results in other countries might have been a little bit more encouraging.
Thank you.